Welcome to the Solomon's Corner podcast, a place for thinkers. Join us as we explore the depths of theology, philosophy, and the Christian intellectual life.
Welcome to the Solomon's Corner podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Roberts. Today we are going to be talking about my friend Norm, not an actual person, but normal things like boys, girls, men, women, can they play football? Can they sew? How do you like that for a teaser? Don't worry, no name shall be used in this production. But first, and I just yelled in your ear, I'm sorry. Make sure you tell us if I'm too loud so that my lovely assistant slash wife slash Asina can also help me with the sound. So before we jump into today's show, I want to let you know, make sure you get your North Arrow coffee. We finally got our first affiliate, so make sure you go check that out. We also had a great interview with them. Rob Mitt is the founder of that. He has an awesome story. We interviewed him last week. Make sure you go check it out. And Lindsay is pulling up the slide so you can see it. There you go. It's not pulled up yet. She's pulling it up as we speak. It's coming.
There it is.
It's up. Okay, so make sure you check it out. Episode 40. It was awesome. He has an incredible testimony about how he got started. You also want to make sure you hear about how he first got his coffee fix in the desert. It's pretty amazing. I was shocked. I also learned a whole bunch about coffee that I didn't know, including how I should make his coffee. So anyway, that is up. Also, make sure you use promo code Solomon when you order. There's a link in the description for you to go and order. You help us, you help out North Arrow, and you help babies. So if you like coffee, if you like babies, and you want them to live, go buy some North Arrow coffee because it's awesome coffee. I highly recommend the French roast coffee. Anyway, also, we're starting to get comments, and we got a nice long one on our Eric Little episode. So I want to read that to you guys real fast. While I do that, are you pulling it up?
Yeah, I'm pulling it up.
Okay. You got it? All right.
No, not for them yet.
It's not there for you guys yet, but I can see it.
There we go.
This is from Teresa M. Thank you for your comment, by the way. Really appreciate it. And I haven't read this in full, so we are all about to be surprised. So, Teresa, if you swore in here, but you don't look like a person who will do that, so I'm thinking that this is safe. Anyway, bottom line is that she said this was an interesting podcast, which you always know means you said something wrong. Because she didn't say it was good, but she didn't say it was bad either. But either way, she gave us a bunch of great stuff. She said, I like some of your points. Just a friendly correction. See, there it is. I knew it right from the start. For you regarding Eric Little's denomination, he was not a Presbyterian. He was a devout Congregationalist, which I did not know. You may find the history of British Congregationalism interesting in terms of their resistance to government authority. Yes, I will. Also, in addition to being strict Sabbatarian, Eric was a teetotaler who abstained from alcohol his entire life. He and I would definitely drink water together. Because I like wine, and I would want to keep it from him because I respect him a lot. And he was anti-smoking, anti-drugging, anti-gambling. He had a very strong convictions and lived a fairly ascetic lifestyle, but he did not push his beliefs on others. He was not judgmental. He was able to stand by his convictions while spending much of his time in worldly settings amongst people with differing beliefs. He approached those with differing beliefs in a gentle and compassionate way. Yes, that I would say is definitely depicted in the biography. Eric first began evangelizing about a year and a half before the Olympics. Public speaking was not his strong suit, but again, he trusted God provided the necessary power. Although he was shy and terrified of speaking to crowds, Eric was once again obedient to what he believed God was calling him to do. Yes, that also is captured in the biography, which I don't have right here, but where I pulled most of my information. As you know, Eric was a pure science student at the University of Edinburgh and excelled in chemistry and mathematics. Therefore, Eric understood science and found it compatible with his beliefs. He was not a Christian with blind faith. Got to make sure you get those negations. His faith was reasoned and rational. As an aside, a fact you may find interesting about Harold Abrams is that Harold spoke to fellow Jewish young people telling them that they should play sports on the Sabbath because proving themselves athletically was more important. In that way, Harold took a stand completely opposite to that of Eric Little's. Yes, And we actually did say that. Oh, is there more?
Oh, yeah, there's...
I think the most important thing people can take away from Eric Little's life is his consistent obedience and submission to the will of God and his compassionate and loving service to others. He is one of the most selfless and saint-like modern Christians. He truly lived by the Sermon on the Mount. Some who knew him even called him Jesus in running shoes. I recommend the books For the Glory by Duncan Hamilton and Pure Gold by David McCaslin. That's got to be Scottish. Is that better? Somebody tell me in the comments if I actually nailed the accent. People make fun of my accents, but it makes the show fun. Eric Little repeatedly chose to honor God, even when it cost him everything from a material standpoint. As you know, after the Olympics, he gave up fame and opportunities for fortune to become a missionary educator in Tianjin. He later gave up comfort with his family in Tianjin to be an itinerant evangelist in a war zone in the remote villages of Sao Chang. He risked his life countless times to rescue the wounded, tend to the sick, and made dangerous journeys to the smuggle of medical supplies, Chinese contraband, money, coal, and food to help the people of Sao Chang and the missionaries at the hospital. He did not discriminate and even helped wounded Japanese soldiers, bandits, and Chinese communist soldiers. In fact, he worked together with the communist soldiers for the common good of the people. He spoke of this in an interview in 1940. Well, that is interesting. How much longer is this quote?
There's two more.
When the British government ordered its nationals to leave, Eric once again followed his convictions and stayed in China while his beloved wife and daughters left to safety in Canada. This sacrifice was probably his biggest. He believed God was calling him to stay and continue helping the Chinese with whom he felt a profound connection. Then, when he became a prisoner in the Weizen intern camp, Eric was a beacon of light to other prisoners with his selfless service. He judged no one. He showed loving kindness through his actions to everyone, from scorned prostitutes and drug addicts to wealthy businessmen with bad reputations. Eric even persuaded greedy and wealthy people in the camp to share food they purchased from the black market with everyone. He became Uncle Eric to hundreds of children separated from their parents, even amending his Sabbatarian rule, refereeing games on Sundays when he realized it was in the best spiritual interest of the children. He taught chemistry, physics, and mathematics to children of the camp and organized sport. He carried coal and pumped water for the sick, elderly, and disabled. He tended to the typhoid fever victims. He helped clean the filthy latrines. He mended broken hockey sticks for the kids with stinking glue from horses' hooves. He shared what little he had with everyone. When the teenagers were having sex parties, Eric started an evening program of wholesome activities to refocus their energy on positive things. He maintained his Christian character until the end. Despite suffering from terminal illness in a prison camp, he was an inspiration to us all. Is that it?
Yep.
Woo! Thank you, Teresa. That was definitely longer than I thought it was. When I sent it to my wife, I thought she could get it all in one slide, but clearly it was deserved. And I did not know that stuff about the communist stuff. But I also will say that while we focused mostly on his, are we still showing them the slide?
Nope.
Okay. Well, while I focused mostly on his athletic endeavors, because of that's the part that basically everybody remembers. It's interesting though, because in the biography we read, we just watched Chariots of Fire with my kids the other day, and they were like, "When are we going to see him in the mission field?" They actually wanted more of that than the sports. Which, you know, again, I just think that's interesting how kids, when they heard his story, wanted to actually hear more about the mission field than they care. They saw the Olympics as Eric saw it. It was just interesting kind of little highlight there. There's one other comment that I want to highlight here is Madam America, which my wife is pulling up right now. Is it up?
Yep.
Okay. You can use your words instead of your thumbs up. I can't see it behind the camera. Okay. Awesome interview. Learned so much. So glad guys like Rob and his partner, DJ, RLTW, my brother was a ranger. I don't know what RLTW means, but rangers lead the way. That's what it is, because I know a ranger as well. That's how I figured that out. Are out there doing this. Go pro-life team. Woo. Go team coffee. Team Jesus. Team worldview matters. LOL. All things. Smiley, smiley, smiley. Thank you, Madam America, for that awesome, awesome comment. So now that we've gotten all the fun stuff out of the way, my wife can now go get some coffee while I narrate this thing and we start jumping into truth. So one of the things, I forgot one more thing, man, we are out of sorts. We're trying to go through the show quick today because we got to get our pens back up and running. And also I forgot one big announcement. We finally ordered our journals. These things are awesome. They're Leuchtturm 1917. They are very much in line with our kind of mission and vision of trying to help people become thinkers. I got this awesome little, where is this thing? I don't know if it's in this one, but one of them had a nice little,
on the back.
Is it on the back?
Yep.
Okay. Writing by hand is thinking on paper. Now, where have I heard that before? Oh my, if you've been listening to this podcast, it's right freaking here. Thoughts grow into words, sentences, and pictures. Memories become stories. Ideas are transformed into projects. Notes inspire insight. We write and understand. Learn, see, and think with the hand. Awesome stuff. For those who don't know, we also make custom pens. Here's one of my favorites that I use. I don't know if you can see that right there. But there you go. We got this nice little fountain pen thing. Anyway, you can check those out on our store at solomonscorner.com. Click on the store tab and you will be able to get access to those things hopefully later this week. That leads me to the last announcement, which is we will have an e-store for our beta testers. If you did not actually sign up for our e-store, you can do that. Do you have the e-store ready to pull up so that they can see that page?
I no? do not have
okay.
it ready, but...
Well, either way, you go to the store tab and then there's a spot on there that you can type in the email and you will be entered into the beta testing. So we've got about 30 people who are ready to go start shopping on our store. Really appreciate you guys. That email is going to go out today or tomorrow. So be looking for your inbox. You will get a password to the store and you will be able to go in there. And it's for us to basically test our transaction process, our ordering process, make sure everything kind of goes smoothly. So we ask for your patience because it's a beta test, which means it's not fully functional and you're kind of opting into that. So if you wanted to be able to get some of those pens before they go, there's some nice pens on there. So jump on it. All right. So moving on, we're going to talk about norms today. And one of the reasons why I think that this is really important is especially amongst Christians, there seems to be this, what I would call gotcha moments, where a Christian goes out there and says, well, you know, I mean, it's pretty silly if a guy wants to not shoot guns, and everybody's like, well, that's not silly. I know plenty of guys who don't want to shoot guns. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's clearly not masculine, because to do masculine things is to want to blow stuff up, to want to like get stronger, to do these kinds of things. That is what men are made to do. Their biological profiles are that way as well. That doesn't mean that there aren't exceptions to this rule. But if there's one thing we've learned about the transgender issue, it's that there are real distinctions between men and women that we all knew were there. We just kind of felt like seeing if they really were there. And so now we've got this situation where everybody is nervous to say something in the absolute. Is that copyrighted, by the way?
It is almost
ready. It's almost ready.
And do you know what coffee it is that's brewing, Daniel?
It's the French.
It's the North Arrow.
It's the North Arrow coffee. Mm-hmm. Promo code Solomon. Check it out. So at the end of the day, we've got Christians that don't really, and not just Christians, but people in general, they're very nervous about making a statement of generalization because everybody is ready to interpret it as an absolute. Now, look at me. Do I look like a very masculine person other than my beard? No. Do I enjoy writing, studying, all those kinds of things, which again, depending on the society you were in, would have been totally more masculine than other societies that we live in now, right? So what we are trying to do in this episode is talk about the distinctions between normal customs and absolute truth and trying to make sure we understand the distinction between a generalization and an absolute truth. Because generalizations are rooted in absolute truth, and exceptions are rooted in generalizations. Meaning, the exception cannot become the rule, because otherwise, the rule becomes the exception. So, before we can start, though, we have to ask, what is truth? Now, before we can have any discussion on normal, we have to ask, what is truth? How can we can ask this as a skeptic or a seeker? A principle that is good for your soul, by the way, is to avoid imitating the enemies of Jesus. In other words, you probably want to second guess your position if that position is echoed in the Pharisees, Sadducees, or Roman pagans, i.e. Pilate, who says, "What is truth?" when he's actually standing before truth itself, embodied in Jesus Christ. Or the Sadducees and Pharisees who say, "He doesn't actually want us to eat his flesh and drink his blood." Now, again, that's not an argument for the fact that you can't be skeptic or not. It's just in general, if you claim to be a Christian and you are echoing these people in your objections, it's probably not in your best interest. Now, truth is a label, all right? We want to understand what this, what we are trying to get at. Truth is a label we give to something that's accurately described in the world, meaning we use sentences or art or something like that, and we say that captures this thing or that thing accurately. A necessary part of a true description is language or demarcation. Again, we use something material. Language is material. It literally vibrates through the material world, and then it goes into your ears and then into your brain, which goes to your mind. Then you have art, which is using other materials to capture something in reality. It's an imitation of reality. And so in that sense, you can say language is just an imitation of reality. It's either close or it's far away. The further away it is, the less true it is. A photograph can be doctored, for example, or it can be true to what is captured. The same with language. It either represents that which it seeks to capture or it fails to capture it. This means that language always has an object in mind. This is where we get the term objective. Either a material or immaterial object, concepts, immaterial, or concrete, my hand. Our words are designed to carry an aspect of the object accurately to the hearer, reader, or in this case, or in other cases, art, the observer. The fact that the world has the potential to be described accurately is the basis for what we consider objectively normal. So you can't have norms if there's no objectivity. And this also grounds subjective desires and faults. We can't say Daniel really likes cheeseburgers is a true statement unless there are such things as subjective realities or preferences. So when we use language, it's best to think of it like this. This is basically a dance that's happening. You have comprehension, which is the qualitative aspects of reality. And then there's the extension, the material aspects. What are we actually trying to describe? What material thing are we actually trying to describe? And Peter Kraft actually captures this really well in this book, Socratic Logic, right here. It is in the description, I believe. Should be. If it's not, then get after my wife. Awesome. My coffee. There we go. So, perfect timing. We got a quote. I'm going to take a sip. This is called The Problem of Evil Cup, by the way. You can get this on the e-store. So, Peter Kraft has this to say. Common misunderstandings come from confusing comprehension with extension, for example, when we judge that males are taller than females. Or we could say, males do not sow. Hold your horses. Or a fish. Gotta swim. Birds gotta fly. We are speaking of the comprehension of the subject in terms males or fish, not the extension. Not all 3+ billion human males are taller than 3+ billion human females. Of course, but the nature of males is on average to be taller than females. And again, this is Socratic Logic by Peter Kraft. In today's day and age, highly recommend you get this book. Highly recommend you actually go through it with your kids. Especially once they get into the teen years or high school years. What Kraft is pointing out here is the difference between our ability to create and our ability to consume in the knowledge obtaining process. We can either create sentences and we can consume them. Right now, you are consuming my created content. It's going into your mind and you're reasoning about it and you're judging it. Is this true or is this false? Is this true or is this false? Does this line up with what I experienced? Is this right? Is that right? Is this wrong? Are my experiences trustworthy? That's that whole creative process. This is the dance of truth, okay? And that doesn't mean that it's relative, because obviously in order to dance, you got to have a floor. So we come to know things through words and things. They are a dance of experience and creativity, but they are not devoid of a solid foundation we call reality. It is this very reality that allows us to understand the essential and accidental characteristics of man and woman. And when we say accidental, what we mean is not that there's a defect. What we mean is it's not essential to being human. For example, if somebody were to say, well, you're more human if you're white, well, that would be a racist thing, because what it's doing is it's making something that's non-essential essential. And it's discriminatory because human beings have many different colored skins. And so we know, given the diversity of skins, that therefore it cannot be essential to being human that you be one color or the other. However, we can say it's essential to a human being to have a colored skin, to have some kind of color, either white, black, whatever, some sort of spectrum of colors or pigment. They have to have pigment to be human. Why? Because we've never seen a human being without some sort of pigment. If they do not have that pigment, if somebody wants to bring up albinos, for example, because they're assuming he's not remembering albinos, no, we would call that a defect because they don't have something they ought to have. In the same way, if we said, well, humans should essentially have two hands. Oh, but what about people who lost them? Well, they have lost something that makes them fully human. To be human is to have two hands. That's the reality. And if somebody has lost one, we try to restore them back to two hands because that's what restoration does. So, moving on. Peter Kreeft says this as well. I am speaking of the comprehension of man and seeing mortal, quote unquote, in it, for man by nature has an animal body and thus is subject to death. When I say all my books are paperbacks, I am simply reporting on what my senses tell me about all the concrete individual books I own. And what makes that proposition true or false is not the essential nature of the things it refers to, i.e. books, qua books. Qua is just a fancy, well, it's technically a Latin term for just as it is. The essential nature of books, what makes it a book. But something accidental, contingent, uncertain, and unpredictable. But when I say all men are mortal, I am abstracting the essential nature of men from the individual men I have met and making a statement about its comprehension that is universal. In other words, all men are mortal is not a tautology. It requires insight into the comprehension of man to know that all men are mortal is necessarily true, and some people have that insight while others do not. So again, this is something where we can say this is an insight. You can't just look at all men. You have to intend the truth. You have to actually come to a judgment about what you're experiencing as a concept. And some people can just sit there and say, I don't believe that all men are mortal, in which case we would say, then you don't know the truth. When we talk about what is true, we ultimately are talking about something that is true in its description of reality. Thus, a subjective truth is something specific to a person, but not to the nature that person has. In other words, Daniel likes cheeseburgers is not a truth claim about the nature of man, but it is a truth claim about the nature of Daniel. What are you looking at me for?
Because I love you.
Okay. My wife needs some more coffee. She's drinking on the job again. I don't know what's going on.
I am drinking on the job. It's just that it's North Arrow coffee.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Hashtag Solomon.
Yeah, there you go. Thus, a subjective truth. We read that part already. For example, another one, Daniel Roberts has brown hair, is a subjective truth rooted in objective reality, that men can have brown hair. This is not essential to my nature, but if on average more men have brown hair than are bald, the bald person is an exception to the statement men have brown hair. So, do you see what I'm saying here? When somebody says, hey, men have brown hair, you don't have to be like, oh yeah, what about bald people? Huh? Well, yeah, of course, what about bald? Well, we're just talking about the fact that men should have hair. And if you talk to a bald person, I've never met someone who doesn't want their hair back. Now, I, for one, would love to have a cue ball, but I guess it's always greener on the other side, right? All right. Now, at this point, someone might say, that's not true. I have a brother who's bald and another who has blonde hair. This person is captured by the legalism of modernism. They see themselves as objective, but in actuality, they only seek to be grounded in skepticism. There is nothing false about the statement, men have brown hair. But if I were to say men by nature have brown hair, it would imply a truth claim that is absolute, meaning is true of all men at all places and all times. That can't be true because I know plenty of bald people. Also, I just realized, yeah, one of my friends is bald and he might be like, hey, what gives? It's totally accidental. There you go. It's not essential to the podcast. You get what I'm saying? You see what I'm putting down there? So, moving on. So what do we do with these truths? What is essential? What is non-essential? How do we discover it? And what do we mean by normal? We had to establish that truth actually exists because norms are just customs that are an approximation to the nature of things. And so you have these communities. Sometimes they're healthy communities like a church or a family. Sometimes they're unhealthy communities or imposed communities by government like gulags or concentration camps. These become a locus of individual souls in a closed area. And what they end up doing is they end up being an approximation of what is good for man and what is bad for man. Nobody would say that it's in the best interest of men to be in a concentration camp. However, communist dictators might say it's in the best interest of the whole of the community. And so you have this question of, okay, well, what do we base this on? And you have to argue for a natural law, or else you do end up in a kind of gulag-esque kind of thing. And one of the things I want to say about this before we jump on to what is normal is people will bring up, you know, slippery slope things. They'll be like, well, I understand the slippery slope is possible or whatever. But if you go on TikTok for a second or follow Libs of TikTok, we're way past slippery slope. We are way past slippery slope in terms of, I mean, we've got people who don't even trust the government anymore because they're lying so much. So we are way beyond this kind of slippery slope thing. I saw a video the other day where a guy is trying to argue for pedophilia and consent of 9-year-olds in sexual relationships. We are way past the slippery slope. We have slipped down the slope. We are in the valley. We are in the ravine. And if we keep going, we're going to find ourselves in hell on earth. And so this is why norms are important, because it is in the same way that an individual is aiming at what is meant for mankind, they do that collectively as well when they come together in a community. And this is what we call a norm or a custom. And so now that we know that truth has to exist, in other words, we can't deny it, because if we were to deny that truth exists, we would be making a truth claim and therefore affirming that truth exists. But knowing that truth is possible to obtain is not enough. We have to now apply certain truths. This is what we call judgment. So knowing that truth is available is just theoretical. When we apply it as it's known, it's a judgment. When we can we accurately judge something, though, as true to its nature or false to its nature? And this, of course, is true. The way that we do this is the beginning with the extremes or things that are blatantly false. For example, that a man is a woman is blatantly false. We can also do things by going to the moral extremes. For example, sleeping with another woman's husband is a good thing for marriages, and the wife of the husband should not be offended. We would say, that's not true. It's just not true. And we know this because we wouldn't want that done to us. And so now you might object to this, and you would be correct, because you could also say, sometimes you just got to crack a few babies to make the trains run on time. We would also say that is not a morally good thing, because children are inherently innocent. Now, unless you read Augustine's Confessions, which we are, in which case you find out that it's not that they're innocent, they just lack will. So, but anyway, that's a separate topic for a separate time. So we would say that all these are morally wrong, and in doing so, we are implying that there is a moral standard or norm for human existence, meaning that if there is a moral law for Daniel, there is a moral law for every other man out there, because I'm human, and if there's a moral law for me, there's got to be a moral law for you, unless I'm the only one who's subject to it, which I don't think anybody would grant. Now, maybe some people, like my wife, would want to grant that, because then I'd be subject to the law and she wouldn't. But you can see how this would quickly turn into absurd. So a moral norm is just a society aiming at what individuals ought to aim at. And this is ultimately the political life. This is the political animal side of being a human being. So the fact that we can agree that there are basic moral truths, we might not agree what they are, but we can agree that they are. We can do this by asking, would I want that done to me? So we can agree on some of them. You shouldn't steal. And some of you might say, well, how do you define stealing? And that's the point of the law, is that you got to have a law, a political law in place in order to define these things. But in general, we know maybe you shouldn't steal somebody's wife. Well, how do you know it's his wife? Well, I'm pretty sure that you can figure it out. I'm going to leave that one to the other people. But the point is that when we discuss norms, we are talking about moral reality that is shared by human beings. And human beings are both spiritual and material. They have humanity, which is their form, and they have matter, which is their bodies. And when those things are united, they are a human being. Now, this provides us with the ability to conceptualize, to empathize, and terrorize each other. We can know what would hurt us, and then we can do that to other people. This is called revenge. We can also... We know that those who don't empathize and those who don't understand what could hurt people are disconnected from reality, that they need psychological help. There is the chasm between the mind and reality problem, that chasm has gotten really wide, and they need somebody to help bridge that gap. So when we discuss norms, we're speaking of generalizations. Now, this all kind of came about, the inspiration for this came about because of this photo that we saw at Michael's. Well, I guess I probably shouldn't say that. Maybe you should cut that out of the actual finished thing, Lindsay. But the point is that we were, I put it in the tweet anyway. I guess it's not that big of a deal. So I was walking along and my daughter saw this picture, and it's a man who looks like a nice man. He seems like a nice chap, nice fellow. On a sewing machine. Now, if you can't tell, he's making purses. Now, my daughter exclaimed, "Why is that man sewing? That is so weird." Which is true. It is weird. And the reason why is because I'm pretty sure all of us can count on one hand how many men we know that sew in their pastime. Not many, I don't think. Now, somebody might have a great business idea and they want to go sew. Get after it, man. Good luck. Also bet you money that that guy's not like looking for a group of dudes to sew with. He's looking to make money. So at the end of the day, this is what happened. And it generated a really good conversation, which made me realize a conversation that I've had almost for the last 10 years on pretty much any time somebody asserts a judgment of that's weird. There is always somebody to come along and offer an alternative perspective, which is good for everybody. But before I keep going, I want to tell this story because it's really funny. Because it highlights something. Because one of the things that came out of this was that that sometimes girls like to play football, which reminded me of this story that I'm about to tell you, which is, I don't know if it's virtuous or if it's vicious, but you let me know in the comments. So I was at a winter retreat, and there was a very, very attractive young girl there who was my age. I was about 16, I think it was. Every year our youth group would go to this. And for those who don't know, a youth group is a church group that goes and basically hangs out and eats pizza. That wasn't really what it was. It was a very cool retreat. But it was a winter retreat. And it was up in Michigan and always happened every February. And we went to this place. I think it was called Camp Barrical is what it was called. And we'd go to this retreat center, and it'd be tons of snow. And inevitably, somebody would always say, let's play some football. And the dudes would be like, yeah, let's play some football. And somebody would bring it out, and we'd be out in the snow in our snow gear and all this kind of stuff. And eventually, you kind of get, like, pretty hot, so you're kind of stripping down. And so you're in your shorts, or not your shorts, but you're in basically, like, a sweatshirt and, you know, jeans and boots, and you're playing football, and it's awesome because you can get tackled super hard, and it just feels like you're invincible. Well, then the girls wanted to jump in and play. Being, you know, 16-year-old boys who obviously wanted to play football with the girls, we said, of course girls can play football. Of course they can. Don't let anybody tell you differently. Yeah. Two-hand touch, right, guys? Two-hand touch. And, of course, every dude's like, don't be a pervert. Be a gentleman, right? Don't two-hand touch where you're not supposed to two-hand touch, okay? And, of course, now the youth group people are all coming out, right? Standing on sidelines, make sure nobody two-hand touches where they're not supposed to two-hand touch, right? Because that's just what shit that everybody knows. You've got hormones now out on a football field, and they are going to be in close contact with each other. Now, as I said, there was an attractive girl there who shall remain nameless because God forbid she ever like actually hear this 20 years later. But the bottom line, because you never know what can go viral. That's the last thing, you know? Now, my wife has heard the story, and she thinks it's hilarious. So what ends up happening is I'm across from the girl that I have a crush on, and I'm supposed to mark her and make sure she doesn't score a touchdown. So they pass to her, and there was a rule. You got to pass to a girl every three passes. Why? Again, because girls aren't good at football. It's just a fact. So what ends up happening is that she catches the ball, and I come in right next to the end zone, two-hand toucher, and she says, "Nuh-uh, you got to tackle me," and runs it into the touchdown. Now, you might think, Daniel, you understood that she didn't really mean you were supposed to tackle her. Well, my friend, no. I'm a man who's after the truth, and I don't have time for women who are going to play games. So I said, okay. And then the next play looked like it was straight out of Remember the Titans. And I say, I've got Susan. We'll just call her Susan. We'll call her Karen. I got Karen. I think there actually was a Karen there that day, actually. But anyway, so I'm standing. She comes over, runs across, and I run across. I'm watching, and I see how she's going to run the play, and they are going to pass the ball right to her again. And this time, I see that she's running this way, and I'm going to run this way. And since she said that I needed to tackle her in order to play football with her, I did. And so she's running this way. And I don't mean like, you know, a little shoulder check. No, I made sure she knew she was playing with the boys. So I fully extended myself as she is looking at the football, ready to come in and catch the football. As she catches, she turns, and there I am. Just full-on horizontal. I leapt off the ground, and I can't remember what it's called, impaled her with my shoulder. And she literally, you know, like feet off the ground, goes like 4 feet into a snowbank, and is just like, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And I said, boom, that's what tackling football is like. Now, some of you probably think, and is that when they're really, the sparks flew? You guys went out on a date? Sadly, no. At that point, I'm pretty sure all hope of any sort of relationship was literally expelled from her lungs. But it made for one of the greatest stories of my life, because at that point, let's just be honest, I kind of knew that there was no chance, and so I didn't have anything to lose. Now, that happens today, I'd be kicked out of church. Like, we would be disbanded, you know, because we weren't tolerant enough. You got to, you know, let kids play football. So anyway, that being said, there are norms. And I was a skinny little distance runner and was still able to quite literally knock her off her feet. Not in the way that you're supposed to, though. Anyway, so I bring all this up because it only highlights the fact that when people are talking and using language in this way, oftentimes what happens in a debate is they latch onto the form. And so let's just say we continue this description. Oh, my notes got messed up. Hold on, I lost my spot. Okay, so we bring up this idea of football, or a boy who wants to crochet, or he wants to, you know, so there's nothing within the nature of girls or boys, though, that impedes them from doing these things. That's what I want to make clear. Obviously, we were playing football with girls, but we were not playing with girls the way we would have if it was just boys, because we knew that if we actually started tackling them, the girls would not make it through the weekend to do other things like snowboard or tubing and snow ball fights and all the fun things that we did that are different but the same for boys and girls. Now, unlike the possibility of having a baby, which is essential to being a woman and unnatural for a man, these things are accidental, but that doesn't mean that they are things that they shouldn't do. The question is, man is supposed to pursue what is essential to him, what God made him to be. These are because men and women really have feminine humanity and masculine humanity. Kind of got that order backing up. So men and women really do have masculine humanity and feminine humanity, respectively. They are equal in humanity, but different, masculine, feminine. And what we are battling right now is an overemphasis on the equality piece. We have eclipsed the differences. Even language reflects this. In Latin, the term asina and asinus are masculine or feminine and masculine. And if you want to know how those are spelled, it's A-S-I-N-A, and you can go look it up on Google Translate. It's Latin. We're doing a Latin class, so that's for my Latin boys and girl, because Lindsay's the only girl who's in it. Apparently, only boys are interested in Latin. These natures, though, are the basis for mankind's purpose. Just like a man is called to honor God, so a woman is called to honor God. That is because they are both human. How they do that has to be different. It has to be, because God made them different. And we are currently reading Augustine's Confessions. And he says, no one but you... Are you pulling up the quote?
Yep.
Okay. Hold on.
Here we go.
All right. No one but you, he's talking about God, can do these things because you are the only one and only mold in which all things are cast, and the perfect form which shapes all things, and everything takes its place according to your law. Now, here we need to make a distinction between what is and how you come to know things. It is undeniable that you know things, but knowing why something exists the way that it does is not the same thing as knowing that it does exist in that way. For example, someone might ask, well, how do you know what a man is? To which I respond, when your wife says, you're a dumbass, do you ask, what is a dumbass? How do you know what a dumbass is? No, because you understand that that's inhuman. We understand how language works. If you don't actually know what something is, then you ask a question. But to ask artificial questions is definitionally irrational. I'll give you an example. I was speaking with somebody a couple months ago. It was right around when What Is a Woman came out. And this just shows you how bad it has gotten. Because we might look at that, you know, advertisement and say, well, it's not that big of a deal. Yeah, 30 years ago, it wouldn't have been. But now we are in such a time of, I don't like to use the word mass formation psychosis because it has a lot more implications. But we are experiencing some sort of mass irrationality. I'm not talking about transgender people. I'm talking about the people who consider themselves normal. This particular individual said, you know, I saw the What Is a Woman documentary, and I just wonder what they left out. What they left out? Like, what are you talking about? You are literally watching the interviews with people who are mutilating children for all sorts of vicious purposes. And you think that there's some possibility that he overloaded the argument, that Matt Walsh somehow overloaded the argument with bias? Now, people do this because they think that by questioning everything, they are the rational ones. But in actuality, they are the crazy ones. In some sense, they're actually worse than the transgender person, because the transgender person is actually committed to his ideology to the point at which he's willing to actually behave as if it's true. But a person who's wallowing around in skepticism is not somebody that you want to follow into battle. It's not somebody you want to be mentored by. It's not somebody that you actually think you can learn virtue from, because all he's going to say is, well, how do we know that's virtue? What we have done is we've lost our minds as a culture, and we are trying to get them back. And this is evident when somebody says, well, you know, there's no difference when, you know, boys decide that they want to join the Girl Scouts, or, you know, there's nothing different between a boy who wants to become a soldier and a boy who wants to make lingerie. Well, no, there are differences between them, and it's weird if somebody wants to do that. And that's not just subjective. It's just not good for society. If you think that a society where 80% of the men are making lingerie is going to be able to defend itself against China, you might want to go listen to a different podcast. So now, when we keep going on this, for example, we're still talking about norms. We're wondering, well, how do we know that we have any norms? Again, it's rooted in truth, and truth is rooted in our natures. When our natures have been violated, we know it. And what's interesting about this is if you read any sort of realist philosophy, which is what I ascribe to, which says that the world is knowable, there's objective truths in it, and our job is to judge it and apply it. That's our role. We don't get it right every time. That's not to say that everything I say is infallible. It's to say that 99% of it is. I'm just kidding. But what I am saying is that no one is a skeptic when they are being tortured. No one is a skeptic when they are being persecuted. They do not begin to question whether or not they exist. And this is one of the arguments that the realist will present to the idealist, who says, well, how do I know I exist? And they say, well, if you really believe that, why don't you go walk out in front of a bus? One of my professors said, that's not to encourage suicide, by the way. It's just the idea is that, again, the idealist does not fully believe what he's saying, because you cannot live a ideology that's entirely rooted in a question. Ideologies are rooted in answers. You either accept descriptions and they're as the answer, or you behave as the answer. Remember when we were talking about art is another way in which truth can be communicated? Well, behavior is another way. Actions speak louder than words. That's where we get that. It's because we all know that a serial adulterer can claim to have unfailing love to his wife, but eventually she's going to say, no, you've got a problem, because your behavior is telling me something than your words. So we have this ability to look and see multiple facets of reality. We can know the truth through different mediums is what it is. We can know them through words. We can know them through behavior. We can know them through art. And I think those are only really the only three. Oh, revelation. You can know them through revelation too. So at this point, it's worth noting that what you ought to be and what you desire are not necessarily related. A girl may think she has a desire to play football, but it doesn't follow that this desire helps her become a better woman. Similarly, somebody may have a desire for the same sex. It doesn't follow that acting on that desire will make them more human. According to the Bible and according to natural law, it'll make them further from what it means to be human. It will be actions against their nature, not in line with their nature. Scripture is clear, and philosophers as well. What you desire when out of line with what God made you to be is definitionally disordered. The question for us is, what actions are proper to our nature? You may be able to do all sorts of things, but you can't do everything. And so this fact requires you, especially when resources are limited, to use them towards what actually enhances you by making you closer to your nature. This is what Lent is all about. The whole idea of Lent is that you would give something up to remind yourself of your desires for material things that are good, but that God is actually better than those material things. And so when you get hungry for that chocolate, or when you really want to play video games, or when you really want to just sit down and watch TV because you gave up whatever you gave up for Lent, maybe it's coffee. One year we gave up coffee. Oh my word, that was hard. And you find yourself realizing, maybe I'm a little too dependent on that thing. Because if I need it this bad to satisfy some desire, then I probably need to think more about God. That's the whole point, is that you're actually limiting what you consume in order to direct your focus, that the appetite for this thing would become a catalyst for you to reflect on your need for God, that your desire for whatever this thing is actually reminds you of where your ultimate desire should be. It's a physical reminder of your need for God. And I don't mean that in the subjective way, like, you know, he just makes me feel good. So a woman might not become a better woman if she plays football. And again, the question, in order to assert that she would, depends on what you mean by what God made women to be. And so the same thing is true for boys. A boy who desires to sow does not necessarily become a better man for doing it. And so regardless of what we want to do, doesn't follow that just because we want to do it, that it's in alignment with our nature. Even Paul says, I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do. But what I hate, I do. And if I do what I do not want to do, I agree that the law is good. As it is no longer I myself who do it, but it is sin living in me. For I know that good itself does not dwell in me, that it is in my sinful nature. So even Paul recognizes this. And again, this is in the same passage where he says, look, these people who have disordered desires, they're condemned to hell. And the things that they're condemned for are violations of natural law. So if you're a Christian, there is a natural law that you have to seek. You're morally obligated to seek what it is and to try to live according to it, regardless of whether or not your community is either, which we'll see further on. So continuing with the example of, I want to play football. Let's just take that sentence. I want to play football. Is that this sentence means something for me, means something for a girl, and it means something for a 6'2", 250-pound linebacker. Each of us imbues it with a different meaning. Now, despite the sentence being the same form, the substance is different. Meaning, it's the same sentence, but who speaks it gives it a different kind of meaning. Meaning that the football they want to play is different. No, nobody, I do not, and I assume the girl does not, want to play tackle football with a 6'2", 250-pound linebacker, unless they want a hospital visit. Someone saying that Paul worked with fabrics, therefore men should get their Michael sewing kits out, is confusing form and substance. Men back in Bible times are just not the same as men today. Hence the reason why that guy's using a sewing machine, which would make life way more efficient, and the materials he used way more soft and supple and all greatness of those things. Now, when one is making a shelter and the other a purse, that also implies a different kind of nature on man. Men are supposed to provide. They're supposed to provide shelter. They're supposed to do those things. Why? Because that frees the woman up to do what she was made to do, which is to mother and bear children. And people will say, what? Oh, no. Well, the most essential difference between men and women is their reproductive capacity. What do you want to say it is? Their intelligence? I mean, some women might want to say women are smarter than men. That's only because they were put down for so long that they feel like they got to come back and say the same thing about men now. But clearly, intelligence is different from women to men. I mean, we had Beth L. McGrew on here, and she's way smarter than I am. So we know that intelligence is not necessarily better than in men than in women, although on average, it probably is. And again, these are the things that get you in trouble for just stating the facts. It's like, well, if 90% of the men on tennis are beating Serena Williams, men on average are just better at tennis than women. Doesn't mean Serena Williams isn't good. She's just good as a woman. What's going on?
Them's fighting words, Daniel.
Oh.
Better buckle up. Yeah. All the Serena Williams lovers gonna come out of here.
Yeah. That's right. Well, we all know that Asians are smarter than us anyway. So let's see here. Lost my train of thought. Okay. So in order for us to come to a knowledge of the truth about things, that things in the world, like trees, animals, men, women, ourselves, and human beings in general, we must be in community with other persons. This community then as a whole will direct individuals within it towards the truth or away from the truth. Man has to have community. It is essential to him. Man is a social animal, meaning he by nature needs relationship with other beings. A community will then establish norms based on the objective needs of the community as well as those of the individual, because the needs of the community are an extension of the needs of the individual. Now, these norms, that's what, when a community says this is what's good for the community, they are necessarily saying it's what's good for an individual. And that's what we call a norm. These norms, if they're not legally binding, are called cultural norms, which then these give rise to laws. So, for example, we might say it's culturally good for a man to know how to defend himself and to own a firearm. Well, then everybody's got a firearm, and then now they're all starting to shoot each other. And lawlessness breeds legalism. Lawlessness breeds legalism. Why? Because individuals are self-preserving, and when a community feels like its stability is threatened, the community itself will be self-preserving, and they will aim at enabling laws that reduce the threat to its existence. So if everybody starts shooting each other, if gangs, anarchy, all this kind of stuff start breaking out in the streets, yes, the government has the moral authority to actually enact martial law to stop it. This is why it's very, very important for societies that are teetering on revolution to keep their wits about them, because if they actually push it towards like some sort of civil war or something like that, the government does have the authority to come in and say, nope, we're going to squash that because a civil war is too much of a risk to the existence of the overall community. So the building block of a community is the individual. Thus, the comprehension of the nature of man is essential in establishing healthy norms or generalizations about what man ought to be or what a woman ought to be. When a society, for example, discourages women from their nature to bear children and have a family, the society loses its ability to sustain itself. Similarly, if a society begins to attribute work that is more suited to women than to men, roles that are better fitted, filled by men, or can only be fulfilled by men, become vacant, and those societies lose its ability to sustain itself or defend itself from capture. This would be capture from without, meaning outside, or it would be capture from within as the society begins to turn on those who are attempting to live in the norms God intended. When we are in a community, we become more whole, meaning we are becoming something more complete, or we are becoming something more defective. We are either going to move towards wholeness, or we're going to move towards deconstruction. Societies do mirror the journey of man to God, mainly because man bears the image of God, and he is intended for human community, which will find its ultimate fulfillment in God's kingdom, the holy city. This is why the company you keep matters. If you find yourself in a gang, you will not be capable of attaining your intended purpose, or at least be significantly inhibited by it. If you find yourself in a nuclear family, you are closer to obtaining what God intended. There is a design for man, and thus an intended purpose. Just as computers are designed to compute, so a man is designed to fulfill the meaning of man. Now, someone who says, I hate people, I just like being alone, again, has a disordered desire. Why? Well, for one thing, we know that isolation is a form of torture. And so for somebody to just put themselves out there in total and utter isolation is to divorce himself from society and therefore from the goods that come from it. But secondly, revelation, the shortcut for those of us who don't want the reasons for truth, just the cold hard facts, God said, it's not good for man to be alone, is one of the first negative descriptions in the garden. Now, I understand there have been hermits, Christian hermits, mystics, and things like that that have gone out and spent time in isolation for a while. Even Jesus goes into the desert for 40 days, okay? But he doesn't stay there. And even, I believe it was St. Benedict had gone out into the wilderness and then eventually became a monk. Now, they tried to kill him. And again, there are exceptions to rules. The fact that there are exceptions to rules does not mean that you can break the rule whenever you feel like it, or based on a desire, or based on any of those other things. So, if God doesn't want me to be alone, then I better never exclude anyone from my midst. That's the other side of the pendulum. And we shall see that this also is a false judgment. So now we come into authority, natural law, customs, and norms. We're going to kind of wrap it all together. So now we've established, yeah, you got truth, you got norms, you've got all these things. Well, so what? At the end of the day, not everybody can even follow this podcast in terms of the argumentation. You know, you can have the best well-reasoned argument and people can still say, no, I'm going to steal your stuff. If you look at what's going on in Haiti right now, it's absolute lawlessness. people that I've met who have been there and are on the ground that are no longer there because it got so bad will tell you that it's just absolutely might makes right. There is no cohesion whatsoever. And the only way that it's going to get fixed is if somebody comes in there with a strong military arm and shuts down what's going on. Essentially, it's just anarchy. So this brings up authority. And one of the things that happened over the weekend was I was having a Twitter back and forth. I don't have the tweets up, but I felt like it really did highlight some things about the nature of authority. As I've been studying the Catholic Church and studying different distinctions between denominations and looking at their authority structures and how they work and some of the benefits and some of the downsides. And there was this back and forth on Twitter. And I don't know who the account was, but one of them said, you know, basically that somebody said, you know, Jesus, because he forgives everything, lets us do birth control. And therefore, if you're not going to do birth control, you know, you don't have, you're not really saved by grace. And so.
Wait, it was saying.
Yeah.
If you don't use birth control, you're not, like, you need to use because birth control.
Jesus, okay. Jesus gives you, you're being legalistic, essentially, is what the Protestant was saying to this Catholic. So if you're saved by grace, you're permitted to do whatever you want because at the end of the day, it's all washed. Now, fellow seminarian of mine, although I don't think we were in class together, he came out there and gave a great response biblically to it. And I thought it was true. It's that, you know, you don't get to be permitted to just do whatever you want now that you're saved, which is true. It's just a biblical argument. But at the but what kind of came out of that was this kind of back and forth, this discussion about the nature of authority and how the Catholics, albeit have done a better job than Protestants on sexual ethics. They've just thought more about it. I can tell you from book after book after book on ethics and sex and the pro-life stuff that the Catholics just have the better arguments. It's just a fact. Now, the phenomenon about this is that Catholics do not know their faith very well. If you go talk to one in general, they're really indistinguishable from the world. Yet everybody knows, well, you know, it's the Catholics. You know, if there's an anti-abortion group, they're going after Catholics. And because they, again, when your enemy is identifying who they see as the biggest threat, and it's Catholics and not necessarily the Protestants, that doesn't mean, again, this is a generalization. So let's practice what we're preaching. This doesn't mean that there aren't Protestant pro-life centers that have not been targeted by, you know, radical groups. What I am saying is that in general, one of the reasons why the pro-life movement has been able to hold its ground for so long is because there was an authority structure that governments couldn't just topple that said, no, abortion is wrong. Contraceptives are wrong. This is how we need to live as Christian beings. They didn't even say this is just, you know, as far as I can tell, that this is how everybody has to live necessarily. They put this in position on their followers, and then the followers went out into the world and said, yeah, this is still good for all people. But the first group of people who were bound to not participate in the death cult of the pro-choice movement were the Catholics. And even some of my own mentors, you know, who used the, and again, I don't like to bring it up because they did a lot to move away from their original positions because they did see them as so damaging. Again, it's just to highlight, though, that the reason why so much of, in my opinion, so much of the reason why the pro-life movement was able to hold its ground was because there was an authority there who kept sounding the pro-life movement in spite of the fact that most people said it was okay. And so one of the problems you have in philosophy, it's the philosopher king situation, is that you've got, the question is, should the philosopher become the king and just rule? And I believe it was Plato in the Republic. I haven't read the whole thing, but I believe that's where it's found. Is that when the king, who should basically rule? Should it be somebody who's just politically savvy, or is it the philosopher who knows reality as it is, even though the peasants and stuff who don't have the privileges of study actually just don't know why these things are? They just need somebody to tell them that they are. And the idea here is that because there is a difference of intellectual ability, how are you going to make sure that you raise up everybody to the same moral standard if they don't all have the same intellectual capability to understand that standard? And so somebody who says, well, you know, it's written on the heart and they just know. No, but that's not the same thing as making prudential judgments. There are plenty of people out there who know that they're a sinner and feel horrible about it, but they don't know what the good actions are that they should pursue because they are surrounded with by people who are just doing bad things, calling evil good and good evil. And so it's harder for them to make those judgments. This is where law comes in and prevents people in that situation from not knowing the truth. This is why COVID was so damaging, because they put policies in place, not laws, but guidelines that everybody followed like they were laws, including pastors who said Romans 13 was the way that you were supposed to follow these things, despite there being religious exemptions. But the point is that without an authority, everybody just does whatever they want because no one has consensus on the matter. And so the same thing is true for customs. When you have power to communicate what the truth is, and you don't use that to convey what is normal, you convey what is weird, you are no longer living up to your obligations and you're causing confusion. This is most clear in children, when you can't even leave them on a Disney Plus National Geographic because the first thing that's going to come on is some 16-year-old who's struggling with their gender identity. That's not to say that people don't struggle with that. It's just that my 6- and 7-year-olds don't need to know that struggle yet. But it's coming in all forms of content. And so at the end of the day, they are doing a disservice. It's not that those people don't exist. It's just that they are not the majority, and they do not necessarily need to have a place in my child's entertainment. So when it comes to the authorities in life, you got governmental authorities, you got capitalistic authorities, you've got private entities, you've got theological authorities. All of these ultimately have a role to play in teaching what is normal. And when they decide that they are going to choose to pursue what is abnormal versus what is normal, because, well, after all, everybody knows what's normal. Whether they mean to or not, they're elevating the abnormal to the status of normal, and they are confusing people. And kids, with especially kids without parents, who teaches them? It's going to be the advertisements at stores. It's going to be the children's shows that they watch because they're a latchkey kid, or because a YMCA director decided to turn on a Nickelodeon show or something like that that has transgender ideology in it. All of these things have an impact on the society and what a kid grows up believing is the norm. This is why it's so dangerous and why it's no longer a slippery slope argument simply because there was just one ad. It's an effect of the actual cause of all of this. We're going to elevate the abnormal to normal, taking root in all of culture and then foisting itself on families and parents. And now parents have to engage in a conversation they never intended, which is, well, why is there a boy sewing? There doesn't need to be that conversation. And so Thomas Aquinas talks about this in the Summa. He says, law is a teacher. And he gives several descriptions about law. There's, everybody knows, like, an unjust law is no law at all. Well, a law that's not enforced is no law either. He gives basically 4 criteria. We've covered it earlier on in the show. What are we doing on time, by the way?
I think we're at like 1:15.
Oh, okay, we'll wrap it up then. So in order for there to actually be a norm in society, there has to be objective truth. And in order for people to know it, there has to be an authority to convey it. You know, when presidents and politicians come out and implicitly or complicitly affirm lies around racism, or even if it's true, let's just grant that it's true. When they do that, what they are doing is they are highlighting something that they believe everybody else needs to believe as well. And those who don't have the time to read the books and go and watch the YouTube videos and get on Daily Wire or go and read all these things, they have nothing else to fall back on. All they have to fall back on is the milieu, the cultural authorities, the political authorities, because maybe they've got 3 kids at home and they don't have time to read a book. This is why this stuff is not merely accidental. It is a symptom in the same way that cancer is a symptom, or, you know, what are some other diseases? I can't even think of them. I don't even know. I'm burning out. What were you going
to
say?
I was trying to think of other symptoms of other diseases. Yeah. I was going to say measles, but I was like, I don't know if that's the direction you're going.
How about COVID? There you go. Symptoms of COVID, right? You get whatever. At the end of the day, you're going to end up with symptoms and effects, or symptoms and causes. You've got an effect, that's a symptom, and a cause. The cause is that people have stopped believing that there are norms, that it's more normal for a boy to go and play football than it is for a girl, simply because there are some girls that would like to play football. But even those girls do not want to play football with the college-level athletes, and the ones that actually do are not even normal within women's standards, just on the average. But we keep jumping out there feeling like we got to stick up for the little guy because of some nameless, faceless girl out there in college who one day hopes to kick a football through a field goal because she can't be a lineman, because otherwise her back will break. So, you know, at the end of the day, I think that these things, again, we're talking about generalizations. It doesn't follow that, you know, just because men on average are stronger than women, that Daniel is stronger than all women. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that in order for these norms and these truths and these customs to actually take root and actually bear fruit in a society, it's not enough for just podcasters and the occasional pastor to say, hey, you know, gender norms are real. We have to do those things in our day-to-day so that eventually the authorities that we have in this particular situation, a republic and representative government, realize that it's actually in their best interest to affirm these norms as well. And here's the last thing I'm going to leave you with. No matter how you feel about this, somebody's getting offended. Somebody's getting offended. Most of the time, people who have an aversion to what we're talking about here, about truth being objective, that gender norms are objective, that it's not normal for girls to want to play football with college males, or that, you know, men should want to compete with females. Like, people are usually concerned about whether or not somebody's going to feel that they're being judged unfairly or that their feelings are going to get hurt. But the truth is more important than our feelings. And our feelings do not convey truth. They only let us know we're having an experience. When we feel good or we feel bad, we have to ask why. This is not an intellectual question. This is a human question. Some people will say, well, you know, intellectuals like to ask why. No, humans like to ask why. And we have to know what the truth is and why it's the truth so that we can live according to it. And when authorities decide to say that the truth is a lie and the lies are truth, that is when it is more important for us to actually stand up to the lies that our culture is purveying, whether that be in an ad, whether that be in a private conversation. But one thing's for sure, maybe we all should just take a minute and decide that the people that we are going to criticize, the people that we are going to object to, are the people who are saying radical gender ideology, saying everyone's a racist, all of these ideas, simply because we have a friend who had a bad experience, or we have a friend who's gay. With the way the culture is going, people are going to have to choose which friends they're going to ally with. They will not be able to hold those two friendships in tension, because one of the friends is going to object to the other. And it's not going to be the ones who are trying to hold up the truth. It's going to be the ones who are trying to hold on to a delusion, who believe that they are a minority, a victimized class, or that their position and values are just as valid as those who have a nuclear family and those who believe that God intended men to do certain things and women to do certain things, and that those are bigoted ideas. Those are ultimately communist ideas where they sought to basically come in and change the nature of man into their image, not into the image that God intended. And if God has an image on our lives, that is the image we are supposed to hold up. And that is true for women, that is true for men. And it's more than just, I go to church on Sunday and I really, really enjoy singing songs. It is We are in a fight for the truth. And those truths, if you read the Gospels, it's very clear from John the Baptist, who precedes Christ and foreshadows Christ's ministry and even is killed before Christ for just criticizing what a natural marriage is supposed to be, which was, by the way, you know, heterosexual. He criticizes this, and this is what ultimately ends up in his demise. And obviously, I mean, we can say that people probably criticized him. I mean, come on, John. I mean, this emperor, I mean, they do what they want anyway. Don't put yourself at risk. Don't say the truth, man. I mean, he could kill you, dude. I mean, obviously, he didn't back down, and he still said it. And it even says that Herod actually liked to hear him speak. The only reason why is that in a weird twist of irony that John the Baptist gets killed in the story of Mark is because Herod's wife, Herodias, I don't even know if I'm saying that right, but his wife, Herodias, decides to, in a weird twist of Adam and Eve, comes and tempts Herod to put John's head on a platter. And just like Adam taking a bite of the apple, Herod takes a bite and of his wife's request and decides to chop off a head. Now, at the end of the day, this is more than just, is Jesus Lord? When we say Jesus is Lord, we're saying he's Lord of everything, and that the laws that he put in place are actually the laws that are obligations for everyone. And that is not a popular opinion amongst the public these days, nor is it an opinion. It's just the truth. And this is what we have to stand for. Anyway, that's all I got. So thanks for everyone who watched. I hope that you guys enjoyed it. Anyone who was on there, I don't know how many made it to the end. This went much longer than I had planned, but hopefully now that our e-store is almost up, these will become much more concise and much more well-prepared. In the meantime, I hope that you guys have a great weekend, and I hope that you guys keep thinking.